Dublin's Talking Sport with Ken Doherty and Reggie Corrigan.
Sponsored by InsureMyVan.ie. Reduce your price, not your cover.
On Sunshine 106.8.
This is the ball of Tiger Woods.
Vern, this is extremely difficult. This is one of the toughest pitches on the entire place here.
Well, here it comes. Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. In your life, have you seen anything like that?
Sunshine 106.8.
A very good morning to you. I'm Reggie Corrigan and welcome to Dublin's Talking Sport on Sunshine 106.8 with thanks to InsureMyVan.ie. Well, Dublin might be waking up to the unwelcome news of moving into Level 3 restrictions, but nonetheless, there's plenty of sport to take your mind off things this weekend. First up, we'll be talking to Stephen O'Brien of the UK Packers. UK. He'll be recapping last week's opening games of the NFL and previewing everything that's to come this week as well. We have our major moment in sport this week coming back as well, and with it being the third week in September, the All-Ireland football final would historically culminate around this date. This week we're going to look back at one of the most memorable memories of that All-Ireland final when Stephen Cluxton had that last-minute free kick in the 2011 All-Ireland final. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that, and we will be talking to Roy Curtis, of course, the journalist, to get his thoughts and memories on it. Really looking forward to talking to Roy on that. It's a big weekend as well in rugby with the Champions Cup and Leinster taking on Saracens and Ulster taking on Toulouse. We will be reviewing and previewing all of that as well as we look forward to what's going to happen. Peter Breen is in studio with me as well to have a chat about that. And of course in GAA, Brendan McLaughlin, former Dublin hurler, and Declan Drake will be having a look at this weekend's games that are still going ahead and recapping a little bit as well on the semi-finals from last weekend. And of course, there's plenty of football to look at, both in the Air Tristy here domestically and a little look back as well to Rovers' performance during the week against AC Milan. And we'll also be looking at everything that's going on across the water and some transfer news as well. Alan Cawley, of course, will join us for that a little bit later on the show. So as always, we do want to hear from you on the show. So we'd love to hear you if you could text us on 087 11 55 777. And of course, we're also on Facebook at Dublin's Talking Sport, Twitter at Sport1068, and Instagram Dublin's Talking Sport 1068. So no shortage of ways that you can get in touch with us here on the show. Time to turn our attention to the papers now, as always, and tonight I'll be joined in studio by Peter Breen. Morning, Peter, how are you?
Well, thanks, Reggie, how are you?
Oh, not so bad, yeah, not so bad. It's strange, every week you're kind of coming in, we're getting a little bit more sport, and then, you know, you get pulled back last night at midnight and there's, more restrictions brought in. I thought it might affect some of the GAA fixtures that we had this weekend with the hurling and all that kind of stuff, but it seems that they are still going ahead. We'll get a little bit more on that from Declan Drake after a while, but it's kind of all a little bit confusing. I know my kids' games have been cancelled, but what's on, what's off? It's very difficult for people at the minute.
Yeah, there's probably a determination by the government to try and keep the sport going, keep morale, in a sense, going, keep people excited, looking forward to something, particularly with the restrictions around other entertainment that's going on. So look, be thankful, I suppose, or hopeful that they're working in the best interest of the country. Hopefully people listen, and hopefully we can continue to enjoy sports, be it horse racing, Gaelic, rugby, soccer, whatever floats your boat. So there's a lot going on. It's been a really, really busy week with sport. And I think when Premier League comes back, when Champions Cup comes back, it immediately jolts up the passing sports fan as well as the massive enthusiast. So yeah, lots to discuss, lots to look forward to, and we still have an Irish cyclist towards the top of the Tour de France and Sam Bennett, who's done an incredible job, really, when you consider the great tests of your mind and your body to do that in France at such a rigorous competition. So good luck to him. He seems to be flying the flag.
And very appropriately, the green jersey is his target, and it's working for him. He just needs 16 more points to attain that overall green jersey. So we really hope that that can happen.
Yeah.
Wish him the best of luck with that. It's been an interesting week news-wise. I know you've picked up on a few things, but one I would want to bring up with you first of all before we get into today's papers is maybe the story from the week with the IRFU, the FAI, the GAA, all going as governing bodies to talk to the government and lay out their agenda and their concerns. And I suppose from if you look at the three of those games, the one that stood out to me was, of course, the rugby and the very, very stark declaration from Philip Brown that there may not be professional rugby in 2021 if things continue as they are.
Yeah, well, look, we all know that fans, commercial, media are hugely integral to the growth of the sport, the existence of the sport, and the fact that we haven't been in a position to welcome fans in over the last number of weeks. Like, you look at it from a Leinster point of view, Leinster conceivably could have six games in a row in the Aviva Stadium if they win today and progress over the next couple of weeks, and that's assuming that the final is going to be in the Aviva Stadium. That's six full houses, you'd have to assume. Mm. That's a lot of money coming into not just Leinster, but IRFU coffers.
Well, as he said, 2 million... from this weekend alone would have been the revenue.
And then the ancillary benefits for hotels and flights and around the city and bars and restaurants and stuff. So there's a massive knock-on effect to the role, I suppose, that sport plays. But there's no point harping on the negative. Mm. The reality is we are where we are. And I think that Philip Brown spoke very well about the realities that are facing the game. It's no harm keeping that front and centre, the stark reality that there will be job cuts. I think the players led the way with initial wage cuts. I would imagine the staff across all the provinces as well as IRFU have taken significant pay cuts. You'd have to assume that there's going to be further pain coming down the road. But look, that's happening for everyone in lots of different industries. So it's just a harsh reality where we are. I think this year, for us all, is to keep the head, stay afloat, just keep the wheel turning. And it's great that we've managed to get live sports, that we've, you know, that there is that sense of excitement, that there is still that aspirational element for fans to look forward to. But you know what, it just reiterated the damage that the COVID epidemic has caused. Mm,
yeah, and in a week where they're trying to increase revenue and increase attendances, ironically, it's the very week that it gets shut down even further. So I suppose the message, you can't stress it enough, is for everybody to just do everything you can to try and get this thing under control, because the sooner we do, the sooner we can get back to some sort of normality. And at the moment, unfortunately, we just don't have it under control.
I think even when you cast your eyes over to the UK, one of the stories that jumped out for me this week, I probably didn't get massive media attention, but Macclesfield Town was wound up with debts of $500,000. Gareth Bale is reputedly on $600,000 a week on Spurs. Like, there's something dramatically wrong with the game when that can happen. Mm. Now, I'm not criticising Gareth Bale. He's entitled to earn $1 million a week if he can get
if he can
negotiate it. But there's something radically wrong. Like, this is a club that would have produced or helped develop the likes of Paul Ince, Ricky Lambert. You're kind of going, you know what, football, you really need to take a long, hard look at itself on this. That can't happen, because it's not just about a parochial club. That's a community. That's a following. That's thousands of people whose lives are affected by that. And so when something like that happens, you know, this is a time now in our sports enthusiasts or participants or commentators, this is for us all to look at each other and to recognise the role that sport plays in all of our lives. And if we can sit back and allow something like that happening, I think the English FA have a major problem on their hands, because this could very well be the start of many. And you know, that's a community gone.
Yeah, but is that not the case in across a wide range of sports? I hear what you're saying, but you know, there are many Macclesfield towns out there, and in across a range of different sports. And I mean, even if you, again, if I bring it back to rugby as an example, you know, the professional game has progressed in leaps and bounds, yet the club game is struggling so much at grassroots levels and is only surviving down to the volunteerism and the great people that are around clubs to keep it going.
It is, and the reality of Irish rugby is that it's tiered in such a point that the Irish men's senior team is the main generator of revenue. Everyone knows that, and everything else tiers down from there. But when you can't get, when they're missing out on the financial benefits of playing matches and getting bums on seats and all that kind of stuff, that's going to have massive consequences for the women's game, for the development of schools, club rugby, investment in academies, getting the best coaches in, all the things I suppose we've been spoiled with in recent years. So success doesn't, as you know, success doesn't happen by chance. It's all about strategy. It's about appointing the right people. And it's about staying true to a vision that I think Ireland has done a really, really good job on in the academy. So
I suppose my point is maybe more to do with not in particular rugby. Every point you're saying there makes absolute sense, but just the governing bodies of these sports and maybe their loss of control of certain areas. So if you take the Premier League is an entity in its own right, but the Football Association controls everything. You know, when you lose control of an element of your game, be it the professional element of your game, in this case with the Premier League, you know, the money gets out of control because TV comes into it. And if you take this weekend, for example, and the way the future is shaping up a little bit, there are no spectators. But with regard to rugby, again, you know, you can only get it if you're a paying customer, you know. So there's so many people deprived of seeing the actual product.
And it's the same knock-on effect in GAA. Same in League of Ireland football and right down the grades. It's the same in cricket. It's the same in tennis, golf, anything that people are participating in. So it's you're right. And look, it just means there's so much discussion. And I suppose you have to try and see where the opportunities and whether there's going to be a new vision coming out for sport. And it was interesting. There was a very good piece with Dermot Desmond, who's, you know, obviously the very successful Irish businessman who owns Celtic, and in The Athletic this week. And he was just talking about the fact that he offered the Celtic job to Sir Alex Ferguson back in 1987.
Yeah, I saw that,
but he was also mooting the idea of the British League and how maybe this could be the chance for English clubs to look back, and maybe with, given that there's Welsh clubs already involved in English football, like Swansea and Cardiff, etc., maybe, you know, the fact that all bets are off now in sports economics, and there could be a wait and see there, maybe this is the time for that conversation to come in. Because when there's going to be a reduction in gate revenue, maybe they're going to have to look at different ways of trying to incorporate that. I don't know. I'm a Celtic fan, so I want to see Celtic compete at the top.
Wouldn't it be gas if there was someone just took a step back and just looked at it and said, right, you know what, there's going to be a salary cap, and that's it. Nobody needs more than 10 million. You know, that's as much as anybody could ever be, you know, want to live. And in football, there's a salary cap that any one player could only get paid that, and blah, blah, blah. You might bring it in across other sports. I suppose it's an impossible thing to say because you're taking out the competition. But, you know, if the rest of the money went then to reinvestment in the sport, it'd be a bit of an ideal world then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think probably with the number of American owners, American investment in sport, I don't know whether they want the social estate to be participating in, which effectively is what we're talking about. But, it definitely needs a better...
I don't think it's a social estate if you're putting a level of reality back into a situation. You know, if you're paying 140 million for one player to go to PSG, it's gone out of control. If you're paying, you know, 10, 15 million as an upper limit, you know, fair enough. But I suppose what the argument then is would be you wouldn't get as much movement around clubs, but that might be a good thing, you know, and it might give everybody a bit more of a level playing field.
Yeah, look, it's a nice idea. I can't see it happening for the simple reason that players would balk at it, agents would balk at it.
But it does happen in rugby, in salary caps in the UK, for example. Yeah. You know, the club can only have, I think it's dropped down to 4.5 million or something now. So they have to work within those. And that does lead to certain situations. But then again, it also leads to situations where we saw with Saracens where there might be irregularities. You know, and the possibility of things not going to according to the rules. But look, it's an interesting one. But there's no doubt the commercial pathway for many sports is going to have to be looked at and worked out over the next period of time, because I think it's going to be a little bit of time before we see 50,000 in the Aviva again.
Yeah, and I think that every sport's going to have to look at itself in terms of how it's going to raise revenue. You don't need me to say that. The fact that there will be staff cuts, there will be pain, there will be cuts in terms of investment, that's pretty clear. And I think that was the reminder from Philip Brown yesterday from the press conference with the Oireachtas. But in other news as well, if anyone, I know it was yesterday's newspaper, but the sad funeral of Pat Smullen took place yesterday, and I know we're going to touch on that later on, but if anyone gets a chance to look at the Examiner from yesterday, there's a really heartfelt column by Ruby Walsh about his friend. And just, you know, again, to reiterate the realities of, you know, beyond sport and how it touches lives, and talking about their friendship and the impact of Pat, not just as a competitor and as a jockey, but as a person, and his loss and how that will be felt as well. So I suppose at a time when we're all, you know, most of us will have suffered some sort of loss over the last period, and you can't really honour the dead. It was a fitting tribute, I think, anyway, and Ruby tends to get it right. Ruby Walsh and Ronan O'Gara are very good columnists in The Examiner, and there's lots of really good pieces going out and about. But so anyway, just if anyone gets a chance to look over the weekend, you should try and tap into it.
Absolutely, yeah. That's Mullen. We will be discussing his legacy a little bit later on in the show as well. Moving to other sports now, Patrick Reed is holding the lead in the US Open. It was a bit disappointing for Rory. Kind of had a mixed bag yesterday, 7 shots off the lead at the moment, but I don't know if you saw much of it, Peter, but by God, what a tricky golf course. Oh, they're talking about the speed of the greens, the difficulty of the greens, and everyone seems to be struggling except Patrick Reed.
It reminded me of my own golfing career. One good hole and then lose 8 balls. But I think how can a couple of players really compete so strongly at one base and then everyone seemed to crumble as well? I don't know. Like, they were talking themselves into this happening. You know, after round one, it was pretty clear. And I know conditions can deteriorate and whatever else, as well as the pressure of it. But I don't know. Maybe, like, is it a bit of an easy excuse for golfers as well? Like, these are top-class professionals. And while it makes for great drama and great entertainment, I don't know. Like, Patrick Reed, as you said, was superb. But there was still some pretty good golf yesterday.
Oh, yeah,
really
absolutely
impressive rounds. And it, you know, but it looks at things as chatting with friends, and we're trying to gauge what's going to be the winning total here. It could be 4 under, it could be 5 under with the way things are going. But, you know, normally when this happens is when there's a deluge and, you know, and the ground cuts up and whatever else. So it'll be, yeah, look, whoever can hold their nerve with no fans there, I suppose that provides a different pressure. Yeah. And also in other sport as well, it'd be remiss not to mention, we had Andy Balburnie, the Ireland cricket captain, on a couple of weeks ago, and he scored 99 not out for Glamorgan yesterday. It's very rare in a T20 game that a batsman gets to 100, and he would have been only the 6th Glamorgan batsman to get to 100. So fair play to him. They beat the league leaders, Gloucestershire, over in the T20 Blast. So himself, Gareth Delaney and Paul Sterling have been brilliant in recent weeks over in T20 Blast. So hopefully that'll continue.
Absolutely. There's a little bit of news coming in there about Liverpool and some transfer news, is there?
Yeah, so they've obviously announced the signing of Thiago Alcantara, and the imminent arrival of Diego Jota from Wolves is expected to be announced over the weekend. I know some media outlets are reporting it already, but wait till you get the live news feed or tweet from Liverpool themselves. But yeah, look, I think Thiago Alcantara, Jurgen Klopp has proven again how shrewd he is. He's waiting and waiting and only buying players who are going to add and push for a place in the first team. He's been smart in recent years where he's identified Van Dijk, he identified Mane, Sadio Mane at Southampton as well. So he's willing to wait his time, and I'm kind of excited as much about Alcantara as I am about Jota, because Jota is a very talented player in a very, very strong team, but he's obviously identified something where if he's going to shell out in the region of 40 million for him, you know,
45 million they're reporting this morning.
It's a lot of money
after what we were just talking about.
Yeah, no, but look, it's exciting because, as we mentioned, Gareth Bale is going to Spurs. Okay, he's probably not going to play for a few weeks because he's injured. Aguero's out for 2 months with Man City.
Yeah,
you know, Liverpool have a chance now to really make a statement against Chelsea tomorrow, and Chelsea, we spoke already, they've invested really, really impressively, but I think there's massive pressure on Frank Lampard now. If they don't get off to a flyer, you know, you could be looking at him come Christmas. He'd be a very nervous man, because he can't say that the board haven't backed him. And by board, I mean Roman Abramovich.
Absolutely. And I see Gareth Bale got back in to do a little bit of training with Spurs as well. So it'd be interesting to see if he does end up going back there.
Yeah, look, I'd say match fitness is an issue for him. The good thing for his end is that he knows the club intimately. He's got Jose Mourinho. He hasn't played a lot, but that might give him a little bit of longevity in terms of his own career. And I'm sure he'd be determined to prove some people wrong, most notably Zinedine Zidane. So it's a very interesting, a very shrewd signing. It's great to the Premier League. I can't think of a more competitive Premier League from the outset. Mm. I know we're underway. And there's, you know, you look at, as I mentioned, the likes of Wolves, Everton, Spurs, Man City, Chelsea, Liverpool.
Leeds.
Yeah.
What a great game that was.
Yeah, you just kind of get the feeling, hopefully they don't burn out too soon. But, you know, but it's exciting, isn't it? And it makes for a lot of positive
talk. It felt
like
a great weekend last weekend. Yeah. one of the great new features that maybe was there all along, I just never saw it, but on the Sky Q box, they have the Premier League highlights thing, so you can basically watch every game in 2 minutes, which is very handy.
Brilliant, for me.
I watched them all last week, and God, okay, the atmosphere thing is a bit of an issue, but the quality of football was fantastic. It really was. There was some cracking goals last week.
Well, the Leeds have set the bar now, and that's what I'd worry, whether they have the depth to sustain that over many weeks. Let's hope they do, because Bielsa is a great character and the league needs a good lead side. So Arsenal as well were very impressive in their own right. Getting Aubameyang over the line will be a very, very shrewd investment by Arteta. Again, he's on big wages, but he's a big player. So it's like a lot of clubs seem to be getting their houses in order, so yeah, it bodes well.
Absolutely. What do you make, just finally, of Tala during the week? 2-0. I know they lost, but it's not a bad result, I suppose, against...
I know, and I think, you know, we're always a bit wary about talking about the plucky Irish and the patronising Irish. Shamrock Rovers get a really good account of themselves against a top-class team who you'd imagine will be contending for Serie A title.
Yeah.
Ibrahimovic is just different class. When you look at his age, and, you know, he gets one chance, bang. And, look, Shamrock Rovers are a very strong team. They're going to be... you'd imagine they're odds on now to win the league title. And I think the profile of them, of Dundalk, getting a good win as well and a potential easy path through to the next rounds as well, is encouraging. And the more investment that we can get into the League of Ireland clubs, we know Bohemians have had a windfall through Matt Doherty. Shamrock Rovers have had their own investment and participate in Europe. And, okay, they missed out on gate receipts in the region of €1 million. But it's great for the profile of the sport. It was just lovely to see a great stadium being showcased around Ireland, around the world, and on free-to-air television here. And it just reiterates the quality. And I know that a lot of people will look and kind of go, you know what, that Shamrock Rovers team tried to play football. Jack Byrne is a really good player. I'm not saying anything new there, but you just get a sense of him as well. He's got quality. He didn't look out of place, and he wasn't the only player there. So, yeah, look, it's great for the profile of Irish sport, and hopefully that can continue to inspire the Irish soccer team and when we prepare for the Euro playoffs.
Absolutely, yeah. It was great to see such quality in town, and a lovely souvenir as well for Aaron Green's son, who got the jersey of Ibrahimovic after that game, which was a lovely touch as well. But it's time to turn our attention now to the NFL. I'm delighted to be joined, as always, by Stephen O'Brien of the UK Packers.co.uk podcast. Hello, Stephen. How are you this morning?
Reggie, what is going on?
What is going on is right. You didn't do too bad last week, 2 out of 4. You know,
emphasis on the word two, but yes, go on.
Yeah, look, we'll give you a bit of a pass because it was the first week back, and you did warn us that there was probably a couple of flyers in there as well. Yeah. So we'll give you that, and we'll get to the ACA shortly. But I suppose we probably need to. Where do we need to start with last week? The books, I suppose, and Brady.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, poor old Tom Brady. God, I mean, you know, he's done so well with the New England Patriots. Everybody knows Tom Brady. If they don't know him from American football, they know him for being married to a supermodel. And, you know, here's a guy who, you know, didn't take top money for New England because he always said his wife earned a ton of money, so he didn't need to do it for the money. So we saw him and Bill Belichick, the head coach of New England, that marriage kind of split. And he goes off to the Bucs, and everyone was waiting to see, well, what's he going to do here with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers? And it wasn't good, Reggie. So he comes out, you know, his passes are inaccurate. He isn't on the same page. But the sort of highlight stuff is that he gets picked off twice. So he gets intercepted by the opposite team. And one of those is a pick six. So they caught the ball and ran back into the end zone. So he ended up losing points. Now, it's week one, is what I'll say. So it's the first week. He's in a new system. He was in the old system since he was 15 or whatever, you know, like a really, really young guy. So it's not the end of the world. But the thing that really stood out for me, which is something that's kind of hung around Tom Brady before, because there's this book that came out called Dynasty, which goes into him and Bill Belichick's relationship in New England. And apparently what sort of got his back up was the way Bill Belichick used to speak to him and the coaching staff used to speak to him, and he felt he didn't get that respect and he wasn't paid enough. So now he goes to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And what does his head coach do? Straight after the game, he throws him underneath the bus, which was pretty shocking to see. Now, his head coach now is a guy called Bruce Arians, and he's known, Reggie, for, I'm going to put this in air quotes, speaking his mind. It's really crass, to be honest, the stuff that he comes out with, because he had a quarterback there called Jameis Winston, And more often than not, he'd come out and try to defend Jameis Winston, even though he'd be leathering the ball to the other team most of the time. So Tom Brady, first ballot Hall of Famer for sure. He's won the Super Bowl more times than me and you have had hot dinners. He throws two interceptions, and what does his coach do straight after the game? He says, oh yeah, well, they were Tom Brady's fault. The first one was a miscommunication. Tom read that wrong. As honest as he like. And the second one, he says, well, he had two options and he picked the wrong one. So yeah, is Tom not playing well? But then he comes out later in the week, Reggie, and says, oh yeah, right, I've looked at the game tape, which is what he should have done to begin with, and said, actually, that first one wasn't Tom's fault. So there's already talk of sort of a fractious relationship between him and Tom Brady. And they asked Tom Brady about it, and he gave this really salty, really sort of like, well, he's the coach, whatever kind of response to it. And they're trying to brush it off as nothing. But I think it's probably a bigger deal. And it's not me just talking in the media. But it was pretty bad form, I think, from Arians. And it's definitely watched this space for the rest of the season.
It's interesting in American sports. And I've remarked on this before in my own mind. And, maybe it's the American psyche, I don't know, but it seems to be all about the individual. So with athletes, yeah. You know, it's all about I did this and me and I and who's the man and the man and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it's a very, selfish type of attitude, and especially in team sports. And even when you look at, like, I loved the Michael Jordan documentary, and I thought it was an incredible series, the whole thing. But you could even see throughout that there was a lot of individuals who were about themselves and not the team. And that seems to be coming out a little bit as well.
Yeah, no, for sure. Because what you hear athletes say all the time in America is I'm a businessman, not a businessman. So they're kind of saying it's all about image. That's why, Reggie, I've had people on the podcast, famous NFL players for the Packers. And you usually get the best stories of the lads who've retired. They don't have skin in the game. You know, they're not worried about losing a sponsorship deal or saying the wrong thing or whatever. So it's all a PR stunt, which is why when Bruce Arians comes out and talks about Tom Brady in this way, you're kind of like, this is not what we're expecting. The media love it because they love a bit of drama. But at the same time, from a man management perspective, and you were talking about, you know, Jose Mourinho earlier in the show with Gareth Bale and all this, and the way these managers now have to massage the egos of all these fellas, Arians definitely didn't do that with Tom Brady, and I think it is bad form.
Peter.
Yes, Stephen, just on that, I think that's more of it's endemic of American society, full stop. Like, it is the pursuit of the individual. If you go back in history, it was the pilgrims who left to go and try to make the best of their life. So that was just, and that's probably seeped into American culture. But on the other side, if you walk into a bar in Dublin and say, oh, I made €1 million today, they go, get out. If you go to an American bar, it says, hey, man, let me buy a drink. How'd you do that? So it's a slightly different approach to success. But I think there's obviously, that coach has obviously identified an issue with Tom Brady. Either he's coming in, he's probably sauntering around, and he needs to kick up the backside. And Reggie, you will have known, and being in dressing room, some people require that, some people require an arm around the shoulder as well. So he's obviously identified that he needs just to rein him in a little bit and to get the very best out of him. And to be honest, by the sounds of things with Tom Brady's career, it's worked so far.
Yeah, but I'd say he had the arm around him more times than anything else when he was in his career up to now. But I don't think, I think it's your team ethos should be that the coach takes responsibility. He's the one responsible. He's the head guy, and if ultimately he puts the game plan in place, and if the players aren't able to follow that game plan or do it properly, well, then the blame lays with the coach because he didn't communicate it properly to them. But it's an interesting thought. All right. Okay, let's move on a little bit. Leave Tom Brady out of it. Belichick didn't really mind the fact that Brady wasn't with them. They went on and won anyway.
Yeah, it's an odd one. Bill Belichick, you know what, I have to give him credit now. There has to be a caveat here as well, because Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, they're sort of inextricably linked all the time. They sort of see the two of them. And why all eyes are on Belichick now is like, well, can he do it without Brady? People kind of forget what he did pre-Brady as well and how successful he was. But credit has to go to him because he surrounds himself with really good coaches. And also, they picked up Cam Newton, because anytime a good player gets cut for character issues or something, everyone just assumes they're going to go to New England because he can make something out of him, because he's the driest guy ever. One of the questions they asked him was, is all Bill, it must be really weird with no crowd in the stadium, and you've been around football for forever, and have you ever seen anything like this in your life with that atmosphere? And he just said one word. He went, yeah, practice. So you're like, okay. So he went on with Cam Newton. And they, as you said, they won. But Cam Newton has a very different playing style than what he'd be used to with Tom Brady. Tom Brady was pretty immobile, especially later in his career. It's actually embarrassing to see him run around. But Cam Newton did well. He wasn't asked to do a whole lot like in the past game. You know, he only had 19 attempts. He completed 15 of those. But he rushed for 75 yards and scored 2 touchdowns himself by rushing. Now, why is that important? It's because New England haven't had a quarterback to do that since 1977. So it's a credit to Belichick to get in, do a gritty game against Miami. Now, that came down to the wire. But actually, I was going to put it in my ACA to go Miami's way, because for some reason, every time New England come up against Miami, most of the time they lay an egg. So I was thinking that was going to happen. It came right down to the end of the game. But yeah, Bill Belichick will find any way to beat you, and it's going to be really exciting to see a guy like Cam Newton. I don't know if you lads have paid much attention to his game, but Cam Newton is just this massive giant of a man. In fact, he complains all the time that because he's so large of a dude, is that he doesn't get the rough and the passer calls when he gets thumped by defensive players after he releases the ball, because he's just so large. But he's a really, really interesting guy to watch.
Yeah, no, I've seen him all right. There's no doubt there's a bit of a beast there. That's unquestionable. I've always felt that the easiest position on the pitch has to be the kicker, and, you know, get out there. Run on, kick the ball over, get off the pitch. But that's not always the case, though. And the Titans kicker, Stephen Gostkowski, he missed 4 in their game against the Broncos, but he still got the glory in the end and just about saved his job with a 25-yard chip shot.
Exactly, and it literally did save his job, because the coach, Mike Vrabel, came out and said, had he not kicked that, it would have been see you. And the thing about that is, it's like, Gostkowski, I mean, this guy is an 87% completion rate. Now, we don't like to talk too much stats. It's very confusing in the morning. But like, for him, he's very good, basically put it that way. He's won the Super Bowl 3 times. He was with New England for ages. And he actually played on the same team as Mike Vrabel in New England, because Mike Vrabel himself was a linebacker for New England. So the two of these are mates. So he would have had to let him go. Now, the headlines are kind of gaudy, right? When you look at it, you're like, oh, 4 missed kicks. You know, he'd 4 field goals, he missed 3 of those, and also missed the extra point. And for anybody who doesn't know, the extra point is basically a chip shot. Now, it's a little bit harder because they moved the back a bit. Now, when you dig into it, the second field goal that he missed was blocked, so you could say it's not really his fault. And then with the extra points, it was a low snap, so I'd say the placeholder put it down, and it was probably dodgy. But yeah, I mean, you're talking about nerves. I've had Mason Crosby on for the Packers, right? He's the all-time leading score for the Packers, and they've been around for 100 years. This guy knows his stuff. But he was explaining to me what goes into the psyche of a kicker and what the process is. The problem with this, Reggie, is, and it's the same with the Irish rugby players like Ronan McGarr and Johnny Sexton and all these lads, is that the thing is that they have a process, and they don't deviate from the process. So you'll see the kickers will look at the ball, they look at the post, they lick their finger, they'll jump upside down, they'll tap their calf 4 times. They have this thing that they go through the same process every time. And if that starts to go wrong for an NFL kicker mid-game, it's so awkward, because there's literally nothing they can do. So they're looking at it, and you can see the confusion on their face of, why isn't this working? Because it's the same process every time.
Yeah.
They have the same count. So I don't know what's going on with the kickers, or certainly what's going on with Gostkowski. But in fact, week 1 just gone by, it was one of the lowest sort of completion percentages of so many failed kicks since 2011. So for 9-10 years, they haven't done this badly. But it seems to be all going wrong for them. I don't know what it is, Reggie, whether it's a quiet stadium, whether they can hear people sort of slagging them off.
They can hear the 20-stone buffaloes that are running towards them now. They couldn't hear them before. I always remember when they were talking about Ron O'Gara going over to American football to do kicking for a while there. It was a kind of a thing. I was wondering how Rog would get on with 4 or 5 of these beasts running more than 2 metres away from him. And it has to be off-putting for a kicker, but it never came to pass. Anyway, it would have been interesting to see how that experiment would have gone. And then we move on. The Green Bay Packers, they destroyed the Minnesota Vikings.
Yeah, that's sort of, pardon me if I gloat too much. Now, this is one of the things I had in my ACA last week, and I said that they were an underdog, because for the bookies, they were. Because we're going into Minnesota, which is a pretty difficult place to play, albeit they didn't have a crowd, and that really sort of helped the Packers in the end, because what an NFL quarterback will do is he'll have sort of a cadence or a hard count. So he'll count when he wants the ball to be snapped. And there's so much trickery there. And Aaron Rodgers, the quarterback for the Packers, is always really good at causing offsides, and it's called a neutral zone infraction. So you'll think he's going to, you know, hit the ball at 2 and it's actually 1, and then the lad jumps offside and then it's a free play. But he's absolutely on fire. Aaron Rodgers has been in the news a lot. And it's because, you know, they said that his attitude at the end of his last head coach, Mike McCarthy, kind of stunk a bit, and he was rolling his eyes in the huddle and not really paying attention to him. They bring in this new, fresh head coach, and the two of them together did fantastic things last season. However, they were still talking about his physical decline. Then what did the Packers go out and do? They go and draft in the first round a quarterback called Jordan Love, and that set the cat amongst the pigeons. People were like, oh, Aaron's not going to be happy now. This is a guy who's very delicate. You've kind of got to massage his ego and all this stuff. Now, these are all media narratives, not something that I particularly feed into. So now they're calling this the Aaron Rodgers revenge tour. Because what's he doing? He's coming out and he's throwing the ball all over the field. He hit 11 different receivers. You know, he's passing the ball off. He's running around the place. And as well as that, they were talking about the Packers' offensive line. So on the right side of the line, it was supposed to be a mess. The game starts. Aaron Rodgers isn't pressured at all. He's so much time to throw the ball, and he's having a field day out there, and he couldn't get anywhere near him. So this Packers team looks really, really dangerous this season. They come up against a good Vikings team, albeit a pretty young defense, so he was able to kind of pick them apart. He's not going to have it that easy as he goes down the stretch, but I'm super biased because I'm from at UK Packers here, the UK and Irish Packers, but I would say if you're looking for some good football and you get a chance to see it, watch Aaron Rodgers in action because he is the Lionel Messi, the Ronaldo of the NFL. He's in his sort of heyday now. He's sort of getting to the end of his career.
Yeah.
Dare I say it, he's still probably got, you know, 3, 4, 5 years in him, I would say. Mm. But still, he looks like he's having a resurgence. So everyone's talking about Patty Mahomes and all these young quarterbacks, Deshaun Watson. But keep an eye on Aaron Rodgers because he's vintage and a definite first-time Hall of Famer when the vote comes up and he retires, for sure.
Will do. Okay, excellent. All right, last week you were close, halfway there. Let's get a bit closer this week with Araka. Give me your selection this week.
Right, this is a five-timer, and I'm sorry, right? It's really hard to get a five-timer off, but the odds are really bad because the matchups are pretty one-sided. But I'm going to go for the Green Bay Packers to punish the Detroit Lions. I'm going to go for the Pittsburgh Steelers to defeat the Denver Broncos. The San Francisco 49ers to bounce back against the Jets. The Chicago Bears against the Giants. That's a dodgy one because you can never depend on the Bears, but anyway. And then, of course, the Kansas City Chiefs to beat the LA Chargers. That's 3-1, Akereji. If you want to increase the odds, well, then you can drop that Kansas game and slot in Seattle to beat New England. Now, betting against Belichick, as I said, is dodgy, but that'll give you a 4-1. So the odds are low, the Ake amount is high. So I'm sure I'm going to get rinsed next week when I come back on the radio. But sure, come on.
No problem. That's what it's all about. We have to take the good with the bad. But you will get there, and your strike rate is pretty hot. Okay, Stephen, thanks a million. Great chatting to you. We'll chat again next week.
Right, Reg, cheers.
Take care. That's Stephen O'Brien there of the UK Packers podcast, of course. Check that out if you're an NFL fan. Some really interesting guests to get on that show. And his ACCA for this week, he's going for the Packers, the Steelers, the 49ers, the Bears, and the Chiefs. Well, it's time for a magic moment in sport now. And with it being the third weekend in September, the All-Ireland Football Finals would historically culminate around this date. This week on our major moment in sport, we're going to look back at the past All-Ireland final, which will forever be remembered by Dublin supporters and not so fondly by the Kerry ones. Croke Park, September 18, 2011, with the game tied at 1-11 apiece. Kevin McManaman was fouled, which awarded Dublin a free kick in the dying seconds of the game. Up stepped Dublin goalkeeper Stephen Cluxton, and one of the longest serving players on that Dublin team. He kicked it over the bar in the direction of Hill 16. The final whistle blew and Croke Park went mad. Dublin are crowned All-Ireland champions for the 23rd time in their history. Let's just have a listen to that magical moment.
We're a minute into injury time. 1 minute to go. It's a free in. It's a free in. Inside the 45-yard line to Dublin, and it's scorable.
Stephen Cluxton, the Dublin goalkeeper, is taking the biggest, most vital kick that he will ever take in his life.
It's to win the All-Ireland. 45 yards out, just inside the 45-yard line. Cluxton with the kick. He has put it over the bar. It's all over. And Dublin have won the All-Ireland title.
And delighted to be joined on the line now by True Dub and journalist Roy Curtis. Morning, Roy. How are you?
Reg, how are you? That transports me back across the years again.
Absolutely.
I'm in good form.
Put the hair standing on the back of your neck. There's no doubt about it. The descriptions, the noise of the crowd, something we're missing desperately at the moment. The atmosphere, but just the tension of that kick and the pressure that was on Stephen to take it. And up he steps and bang, over it goes.
Yeah, it's what makes a great sporting moment. I suppose it's the ability to move people, to plant an imperishable memory deep in our psyche. I mean, I was in Genoa when Packy made that penalty save in Croker the day Ireland beat England in the rugby. And you just have these magical moments. And I think that had all the ingredients. It was a moment that lit up so many lives. I mean, Dublin were seeking a first All-Ireland in 16 years. That it was against Kerry made it more special, that the game was lost basically with 7 or 8 minutes to go, and Kevin McManaman scored that incredible goal. And it's one of the few times I've been in the bowl of a stadium and actually felt it shudder and shake. The emotion, the release, and the tension of those last 5 or 6 minutes. Mm. It hadn't been a great game up to then, to be perfectly honest, but there were some extraordinary scores in the closing stages. Kevin Nolan got his only ever point for Dublin. Kieran Donaghy got an extraordinary point from underneath the Cusack stand. The drama was building to this crescendo, and then a free kick and a goalkeeper having to run 70 or 80 yards, time standing still, this silence falling upon the crowd, and then a detonation of joy. All those years of frustration, Dublin had conspired, it seems, to lose big games in so many different ways, through errors, through misfortune, through the brilliance of opponents. And here was liberation. Here was the sunlight after the clouds. It was, I think for a lot of people, it was a deeply personal moment, like all great sporting moments are. I know that day, my father had died not long before, and he had introduced me to the Dublin team of the 70s, and we went along to that, and I was a kid, I was part of Heffo's army, I felt like the biggest man in the world. And that day I had written a piece in the programme about that experience, and my mother and my two brothers were there, and I remember going to them after the game. I was in the press box, but finding them in the Hogan stand and just having this intense moment of, I don't know, do you call it love, of just feeling so close to somebody, of feeling no words required, and you just held them and you cried, and they're the beautiful moments really for me.
Yeah, absolutely. They're what makes sport, there's no question about it. But I suppose there was a huge burden coming in, as you said, the 16 years, the weight of expectation, because that team were so good, and the kind of there was a bit of a feeling of maybe of underachievement around them, and this, you know, I was wondering, would they get there again?
Very much so. I mean, you know, Reggie, with Leinster, when Munster, it seemed, had the upper hand,
yeah,
and were winning games, and it was a bit like that, the relationship between Dublin and Kerry, or Dublin and Tyrone,
yeah,
and this felt like almost a last chance, that if they didn't do it on that day, a bit like, say, the Leinster 2009
exactly.
game in Croker,
yep,
that this was emerging from that shadow, reasserting an identity, saying no more backward steps. And all that Dublin have achieved in recent years was triggered by that one kick. I often wonder, the 5 in a row, the 7 All-Ireland since 2011, would any of that have unspooled in the way it did had Cluxton kicked that ball wide? Because the doubt that would have been sowed, the notion, the pressure, you would have seen, I think, players drift away. Young players now who come into a squad that just bursts with confidence, with certainty that they are the best. All of that finds its genesis in that one kick. It was the most important kick in the history of Dublin football.
Well, that puts a lot of weight. And I suppose the shoulders that you put it on there to take it as well, one of the most unassuming of the Dublin players, who never really let it go to his head or wanted the glory associated with it, with Stephen Cluxton.
Cluxton really is an exemplar. If you talk to Jim Gavin about Stephen Cluxton, Jim is very rarely given to praising individuals. He is very much about the collective, about the greater good. But he can't help himself with Stephen Cluxton.
Yeah.
He sees sort of this driven character who, nearly 20 years into his inter-county career, is still the first man at training, the setter of standards. I know there was one instance after the draw in All-Ireland last year where Cluxton blamed himself slightly for Killian Spillane's goal, and spent hours and hours watching tape, apparently, just seeing how he could position his feet better had he his toes pointed at the wrong angle. Literally that attention to detail. And that's what he is. I mean, the guys in the dressing room will tell you, he really sets standards. He pushes people to the brink. He sets an example by what he does. He will go down in Dublin GA as great a figure as there has been, up there with the Kevin Heffernans, up there with any of the footballers of the 70s, up there with Jim Gavin, and perhaps ahead of them all, even. And that was his moment in time. I mean, this guy made his debut in 2001, is still the first choice goalkeeper as he approaches 40. You just, in an age where everything seems
everything
to be fighting.
He was the greatest. I'll have to stop you there, Roy.
Okay,
we could go on all day about it, but I'm out of time, unfortunately. Great to chat to you, Roy Curtis. That was our magic moment. During the week, Irish horse racing was hit with the very sad news of the death of Pat Smullen. Of course, Pat was the Irish flat racing champion jockey, and he held that title 9 times between the years 2000 to 2016. He'd be most remembered for his riding to victory of Hazard in the Epsom Derby and the Irish Derby in 2016. Let's have a listen to Pat Smullen's tribute.
We rode Vinnie Rowe to win 4 consecutive Irish St. Ledgers.
Vinnie Rowe and Pat Smullen striding away to an unprecedented 4th St. Ledger.
He rode a brilliant race to win the Matriarch.
Patrick Sullivan drives him through with the Matriarch. 1, 2, 3.
And he won the Irish Derby for my mother and Grace Swallow. It was a very special day.
It is Grace Swallow who wins the Derby for Pat Smullen and Dermot Well.
I was very fortunate to travel the world with Dermot, and we had a lot of success, but if I was to pick one, it's the Epsom Derby and Hazard.
Hazard is putting out more, and it's Hazard in the colours of the Aga Khan who has won the Investec Derby for Pat Smullen and Dermot Well.
He was a total professional. Everything he did, he gave it all in every way, and that's the way he is as a human being.
What more can you ask for somebody to be the one that everybody should aspire to be like?
I'd like to think that throughout the 25 years that I was a jockey, that I conducted myself in a proper manner, and I think that's something to be proud of.
Yes, Pat Smullen there, fondly remembered as one of the greatest champion jockeys that Ireland had, gone far too soon, and our condolences to all of his family and friends. May he rest in peace. Okay, time to turn our attention now to rugby, and there's a lot going on this weekend as the Champions Cup takes place. Leinster, in this part of the world, will be the one that's on people's minds most, but of course Ulster do have to take on Toulouse as well, and there are 2 other games going on in that competition as well, so I'm delighted to be chatting with Peter Breen about that. So Peter, it's very exciting. We saw Leinster get the business done last week and attain another title, but truth be told, the big one is always the Champions Cup, and it's the one that everybody talks about, and it's the way that they measure themselves with the stars that they put on their chest. And Leinster very definitely chasing a 5th. But although Farrell is out for reasons best known to himself of this game, you could say it's still going to be a huge challenge trying to beat Saracens.
Yeah, no other opposition will sharpen Leinster's instincts more than Saracens, particularly given the fact they were the last team to beat them back in May. That's 25 games ago, so when you count in that incredible record. So, you know, you've got Mark McCall, who's been one of the most decorated coaches in the history of the game. You've got Leo Cullen, who's certainly on track for the same. And Saracens will come over here, I suppose, with a star-studded squad, albeit depleted. You mentioned Owen Farrell isn't available. They've obviously lost a number of players as well, but they've been in decent form of late, and they've had 8 months to prepare for this game. It's the last meaningful game that Saracens are realistically going to play for, you know, you'd have to guess about 12, 14 months. So Saracens will be absolutely gunning. They're not going to be in Europe next year, and they're a dangerous opponent. You know, we know the quality that Leinster have. We know the quality that Saracens have. It's going to be an arm wrestle. The bookies have Saracens at 11-4. I know we talk about the bookies a lot, but it just gives a sense of where they see it. I think they're generous odds for Saracens. I'm not saying necessarily that Leinster will lose, but it's just going to be a really, really tough game. Saracens have been bolstered by the likes of Mako Vunipola coming back from injury. They're very battle-hardened. They know what to expect. They have a really tough edge. And as I said, Mark McCall and his coaching team will have this Saracens team pumping to come over to Aviva. And as we mentioned, there's no fans here, so that does negate the
threat.
It does.
It does. It's a huge advantage from Saracen's point of view coming in there, because that crowd noise and that intimidation factor is gone.
Absolutely. And as I said, they've a They've a number of Scotland internationals. They've a raft of England internationals. They're a very, very experienced lineup. They know what it takes to win against Leinster. They know what it takes to win here. So Leinster, you know, will approach the game in a very professional attitude, with a very professional mindset. Bar Saracens and you know, the last year's final, Leinster have a very good record against English clubs, full stop. And with Stuart Lancaster there, who would intimately know the English players and their strengths and weaknesses, with Robin McBride as well, from all the years he would have spent poring over their defence and their offence when he was coaching with Wales, Felipe Contepomi the same, and obviously Leo Cullen, who's heading up and doing such an incredible job there. You know, it's just going to be a fascinating game. Is it the tie of the weekend? Maybe not. Maybe Claremont Racing is going to be one to really set the pulses light. But I tell you something, if you're looking for a purist game of rugby, and that's not to say that the quality won't be there, but just a really tough physical game, this is the game. And I think it's, yeah, look, it's all to play for. Leinster won't want to lose this record, and you know, Saracens, as I said, they've a lot, they've nearly have nothing to play for, and they've it all to play for as well on the other side as well. So nobody's really given them a shout. That makes them a very dangerous opponent.
I think, I think they're going to be extremely dangerous, and I think Leinster feel that as well. I mean, a lot of the chat during the week, a lot of the chat in the build up to the game was very respectful from Leinster, and you know, oftentimes you can hear with coaches and players that they're giving a little bit of piecemeal, they're giving a little bit of, you know, oh, well, we're respecting our opponents type of thing. And you know it's just chat. You know deep down they're really feeling, well, yeah, but we're going to get the job done. There's a number of questions. I don't feel that's the case this week. I mean, listening to McBride, listening to the way Leo's talking, Felipe, the different guys, they are genuinely concerned about this Saracens outfit. They do realise the quality that's there. As you mentioned, the likes of Vunipola coming back at Loosehead, Leinster haven't managed to get Tadhg Furlong back at tighthead. Now Andrew Porter is a more than worthy replacement in that position. But there's a lot of experience in Vunipola, and he comes back there. So it'll be very interesting. I'm really interested in the matchups. It's going to be really interesting to see how that Porter-Vunipola matchup comes in the scrums, for example. Vincent Koch, another brilliant player there at tighthead, up against Cian Healy. And we see Sean Cronin getting the nod ahead of Kelleher. Now, Kelleher started in that final last week, but you'd have to say there were question marks around the Leinster lineout. A lot of people made a point of that. And here we go again. You see Leinster looking to make changes that are aimed at fixing that situation. There will be those who maybe wonder about Sean Cronin's ability at line-out. I mean, he's an incredible player in every other aspect of the game, but in the past, line-outs have been an area that have let him down somewhat. But, you know, he gets the nod this week. So, again, Jamie George versus Cronin. Another interesting matchup at hooker.
Yeah, I think, and the line-out leads into the second row battle, and you're looking at Maro Toji against James Ryan. You've obviously got Devin Toner and Tim Swinson there as well. But the Maro Toji, James Ryan, if you're into rugby at all, that's going to be probably the Lions' second row next year. You could conceivably say that, you know, there's a lot of talk whether James Ryan could be captain of Ireland maybe at some point. Maro Toji maybe the same. So that's the one to really, you know, you talk about individual battles the whole time, and I know Good against Sexton will obviously trigger a lot of interest, but for me, I think that's the one where you're going to see two absolute titans of the world game come up against each other. And you're right, you know, it's Leinster have managed in such a clever way, and such a, through the ability that they have in the squad, they can bring in, they can rotate, manage Josh van der Fleer's man the match last week to the bench. They can bring in Will Connors. I mean, you remember the job that Will Connors did on CJ Stander 2 weeks ago. And I suppose that's maybe disrespectful to Will Connors, because he's more than a negator. You know, he is a really imposing player. He's a guy who's making his way with Caelan Doris, who you imagine will have really bright futures, not just in blue, but in green as well for Ireland. And this is going to be another huge test for them. We have to respect the fact that Leinster do have a lot of young players, even though they have picked up a lot of experience. This is a different level. This is a different level to what they faced this year. And with no disrespect to Munster and Ulster, those were also games that you could nearly view in the sense of a pre-season, in terms of picking up fitness, in terms of picking up that element of sharpness. This is test match intensity. And you know, and my only concern about Marco Vunipola coming back is that he's probably undercooked. I think Saracens would have liked him to get at least a game under his belt. But Saracens have been brimming along quite well. They've been astutely looking at games that they can target in the build-up to this, and they rested their whole starting 15 last week. So that tells you that Mark McCall will have
to
prime.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we're going to see almost a little bit of the caged animal approach coming from Saracens at the beginning of this game. I think they're really going to come out of the traps fast and try and catch Leinster on the hop. I think that'll be Mark McCall's game plan. You know, really, let's shock these guys. Let's put them back in their box a little bit and just worry, make them worry about what we're going to do. Now, I think key to that is Billy Vunipola. You know, the number eight is always at the centre of everything good when Saracens play well, and if he has a big performance. So from a Leinster point of view, I think the likes of Connors, Jack Conan and Caelan Doris will be trying to stifle Billy Vunipola and stop anything that he does, because if he gets any momentum going, the team do get good go forward.
Yeah, and I think that the battle then from Richard Wigglesworth against Luke McGrath, scrum half, will be really an interesting one, because they'll be looking to take that bit more initiative. Mm. I know that Wigglesworth will be trying to take that bit of pressure off Alex Goode, and they're going to try and unleash their back line. Leinster have a little bit of inexperience. Connors and Hugo Keenan are making their European debuts today. Hugo Keenan's been a real revelation in recent weeks. But again, this isn't the same calibre of test that they're going to be facing today. But that's an exciting matchup. So Keenan against a very experienced Lion and Scottish international and Sean Maitland. So there's so much to look forward to. Yeah, but then there's the potency of James Lowe. There's the potency of Jordan Larmour. Mm. Gary Ringrose has been in good form. And Jonathan Sexton, I think this will be... He rarely shirks a massive game, and this is a massive game. And as captain, he'll be looking to get on the front foot and really impose Leinster early. And I think that if a team can get 5 to 10 points clear, I think they're going to be very difficult to catch. It's like a horse going 3 or 4 lengths clear, you know, coming into the final straight as well. It's just because the quality of defence is so strong with both. So it's going to be such a tough arm wrestle now to manage that and to try and take your points and to take any opportunities that come their way. Pascal Gauzère, French interpretation referee, will certainly throw something into the mix. But yeah, a lot to look forward to, and it's one of four really tasty quarterfinals.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to it as well. I do not agree with the bookies. I think Saracens are much stronger than they're being given credit for in the odds that have been given for them against Leinster. But I'm backing blue all the way. Of course, I do think Leinster will get the job done, but I'd love to think that we might get 10 points clear at some stage, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think there's going to be no more than a score in this at the end of the day. I do think there's a bigger game in Leinster. I don't think we've quite seen them in the last few weeks, even though they're winning. I still don't think that we've seen the absolute best from them. I think there's more in there to come, and I'm just hoping that today is when they're going to bring it.
No, Leinster haven't had to, and that's probably will stick in the craw of Ulster and Munster, but they haven't had to, and they're definitely holding things back. So the ability to freshen up people, that gives you a sense of a game plan and where they see the game is going to go today. Leinster don't make changes nilly-willy. Everything is tactical, everything is thought through, and it would have been done over a long period and poured over. So, yeah, so the incentive then for Leinster Saracens is a home tie against Claremont or Racing. And that match next week, just to kind of whet people's appetite, potentially will be on Virgin Media 1 and Channel 4. And I always had a sense with Leinster from my own time working at Leinster Rugby was that with the matches moving to Sky Sports around 2008 after Munster won the second Heineken Cup, it never really caught the hearts and minds of the entire nation because it wasn't free to air. And I think without over-egging it, because the Ulster-Toulouse match will be on free to air tomorrow, I think that's a really good opportunity for Leinster next week to really hammer home and get it out and get it to as wide an audience as possible to really capture those hearts and minds. So that won't be a concern for today, but it's a nice incentive for next week.
It's an incentive, but a lot of work to do before they get there. Okay, then we've got other games going on. You mentioned Claremont Racing later on today at 5:45 this evening. Now, that's an absolutely tantalising matchup.
Yeah, look, you've got Zeebo at fullback, Dunnock Ryan on the bench from an Irish perspective, Claremont, the perennial bridesmaids. I love Virumi Vakatawa. I think he's the most exciting player in the world in Racing. And Finn Russell is doing an incredible job. Their scrum half is top class in Teddy Irabaran. I always could worry about Claremont. I just don't know if they have the bottle. They have the talent, they've got the will, they've got brilliant passion, passionate support. But the fact they lost to Bayonne last week, 21-19, will probably hone their instincts for this weekend. But you look at it, like the winner of Leinster Saracens will play that winner next week, and you could nearly say that'll be the final. So yeah, it's very, very interesting from a racing point of view. You'd imagine they're going, and then there's an English derby, England Exeter against Northants against Toulouse and Ulster. So you'd imagine that Exeter will edge that, and then I think if Ulster were to win and Toulouse, it'd be their greatest ever win.
Yeah, it sure would. You know, the thoughts of going to Toulouse, although we've done it with Leinster and won over there, it's incredibly daunting. It's a very, very hard place to go and get a result in. One of my earliest memories was going away to Toulouse in the very early days of playing with Leinster and, you know, basically getting the game, I'll put it politely, getting it handed back to us. we just weren't at the races that day, and we quickly learned that the gulf there was between what was professional rugby in France at that time and what we were considering professional rugby in those early days of the late 90s, early noughties. Toulouse were everything that Leinster at the time wanted to become. And it's a little bit ironic that it's gone full circle now, where Toulouse are trying to regain that notoriety within the game. Certainly in Europe, they of course have won it four times as well. But Leinster have kind of passed them out in their kind of consistency in recent years. So Toulouse are back. There's no question about it. They're a brilliant team, having gone through maybe the doldrums for a little while. So I feel that Ulster are really, really up against it in this game.
Without Coetzee as well is a massive loss for them. They need all their big animals in the pack rare.
And on
to
the
go.
Back of, you know, their last defeat to Leinster, you know, kind of the confidence can't be that high. It really can't.
No, and I know they've freshened things up. Jack McGrath and Cooney come back in, you know, which probably suggests that they wanted to earmark maybe Cooney for this game this week.
Mm-hmm.
But Roman Antemak, Emile's son, and against Billy Burns at 10, you know, you'd imagine Antemak will have the edge there. You've got Johan Huget and Cheslin Colby on the wings, Antoine Dupont pulling the strings at scrum half. Like, they've a really talented team. You know what? We don't know. Like, stranger things have happened. But I think the back row matchup is really where it's going to be won and lost. And they've got Kaino, Francois Cross, and Salavasio Tolofua against Sean Reedy, Jordy Murphy, Nick Timoney. And really, on paper, certainly, you would say that Toulouse at the edge. But you know what? Ulster will be throwing everything at this as well. So let's hope that they can get that win. And I, as I said, I think it will be their greatest ever win if they can manage it on the road.
No question about it. Okay, that's all we've got time for on the rugby this week. Great chatting to you, Peter. Time to turn our attention to GAA now. And I'm delighted to be joined on the line by former Dublin hurler, Brendan McLaughlin. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Reg.
How are you? Are you well?
Good, good.
Yeah, I'm. I suppose, like everyone, we're happy that these games are still going ahead, considering the circumstances. But a big final this weekend, of course, as Coola take on Ballyboden, and two teams that you know very well. But you know, they've been sort of the powerhouses for the past while in this championship.
Yeah, they are. I suppose they're the two teams that everybody else is trying to get to. But tomorrow is going to be like a game of chess in the first, I suppose, the first half, first 15 minutes of the game. They'll be trying to figure out what sort of patterns are going to expire. But like, you've got Coola, who have a system of play over the last 10 years, I suppose, and everybody's been trying to break it down. And now Bowden are similar to the way Coola is set up. So it's going to be interesting to see which one sort of comes out on top.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Coola, they had a good bit of work to do in their semi-final against Lucan Sarsfields. They were losing by 4 points a long time. And even in, midway through that second half, Sarsfields were holding the lead, but a goal from Sean Moran, of course, changed that. But they're going to have to work today. It's by no means going to be an easy task for them.
No, they basically what happens with Coolah, they start off slow enough, and Lucan came at them with everything they had in the first half, and obviously they were 2 or 3 points up at half time, and everybody was going, oh, hold on, what's going on here? But as you said, Sean Moran came up with a goal, and once they drew level, they sort of put on the afterburners. You had David Tracy, Sean Tracy come to the fore then, and I suppose when you have the likes of Darragh O'Connell in around the middle of the field, they sort of start taking things over, and once they get 1 or 2 points up, it goes to 5 and 6 fairly quickly without you even noticing, which I suppose it's good for them because it shows how good they really are.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, it was kind of a similar story with Bowden. They won by 6 points in the end, but they were kind of struggling a little bit against Nafina. It took them a little bit of time to get into their rhythm.
They did. Like, and it's with I suppose, Bowden, they have a lot of experienced lads there. They have Paul Ryan, they've got Conal Keeney, they've Simon Lambert at centre-back. And once they got a foothold in the game and they figured out what Nafina were doing, they were able to pick Nafina apart then in the last, I suppose, 10, 15 minutes. If Simon Lambert was picking up a lot of short puckouts from Finn McGarry in the goal, and he was distributing the ball very well into the forward lines at angles, which allowed the likes of Paul Ryan, Niall Ryan, and these lads to go at Nafina. And Nafina just didn't have an answer. And similar to what Coolah do, when they get ahead of you, it's very hard to get back. So tomorrow, it's going to be that way. The two of them are just going to be looking at each other and saying, hold on a minute, how are we going to expose the full back lines and get our big players on the ball? The league, I suppose, listen, you have Conn O'Callaghan in the full forward line and Mark Shute with Coolah. And if you get good ball into them, it's very, very hard to stop them. Because the two of them when they get moving, it's hard to stop big men and fast men like Conn.
Okay, I'm going to put you to the test. Who do you fancy tomorrow? I know it's a difficult one to answer, but where is your head telling you it'll go?
I would go with Coolah for about 4 or 5 points.
Right.
And just because I think they have firepower from all over the field. So I can't see Bowden, how would you say, score as much as they did last day. And if Coolah put the shackles on the likes of Conal Keeney and Paul Ryan, I think Coolah about 4 or 5 points.
Okay, great stuff, Brendan. Appreciate that. We'll chat to you again and enjoy the game.
No problem. Thanks a million, Reg.
Thanks a lot. That's Brendan McLaughlin there, former Dublin hurler, of course, who has done plenty of coaching around the province as well in recent years, but his view on that game fancies Coolah to go one better and get all the way to the final. There'll be a good friend of mine, Jack Nolan of Ballyboden, who would like to think differently, I'm sure, along with the rest of the Ballyboden people up there. A club have enjoyed huge success in recent years, so shout out to them. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. I suppose, Peter, yeah, Coolah have kind of become a little bit legendary in recent years with the way that they've changed things around out there, and Des Cal always going on about them and promoting how much work that's going on. And I've seen it firsthand myself. It's an amazing setup.
Yeah.
So you can see why Brendan would be leaning towards them.
Yeah, they're a great indicator of what can happen when you get a very organised club with a very strong youth to underage setup in an area. I imagine Dalkey wouldn't have been renowned for the production of many Gaelic players in the distant past, but when you look at it in recent years, they're the absolute template now of how to go about how to tap into a community in the wider catchment area and to really capitalise on that, and just through organisation and a lot of hard work and a lot of volunteerism. Des Cal, as said, has been flying the flag for Coolah for many, many years, but it's great to see. And look, Conn O'Callaghan, no better man than him, who's a real, you know, one of the real stars of Dublin football as well as of Irish football.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we're joined on the line now by our own Declan Drake. Morning, Declan, how are you?
Very good, Reg, thank you.
Good to chat to you. Before we get on to looking at the football from last week, I suppose your view on the game today, Coolah against Bowden, who do you fancy?
I think the first thing to say is if you'd asked anyone at the start of the championship, Reg, which two teams would be in the county final, very few people would have gone against the duo that we have tomorrow. I mean, they've won every title bar one between them since 2013, you know. I agree a lot with what Brendan just said there beforehand. Very close game in prospect. I would tip Coola to come through, maybe a little bit tighter than what he's suggesting, maybe just 1 or 2 points. But I think it's going to be an absolutely fantastic game of hurling there tomorrow. And the best luck to both teams on the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we were a little bit nervous when we came in here this morning because with the announcements last night, we weren't really sure what was going to happen with those games going ahead. It said elite sports, so obviously we fall under that category.
We do, thankfully. Yeah. Yes, we are. We are going to complete our championships, which is a tremendous credit to everybody involved. The only difference between yesterday before officially 6 o'clock and today is the fact there'll be no supporters allowed tomorrow, which there would have been yesterday. Mm. So that's a huge disappointment because this is a contest that would have had 5,000-6,000 people in Parnell Park tomorrow afternoon, you know. But look, that's the circumstances we're in. We're just glad that we have a county final to look forward to tomorrow.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's have a look at last week then. We discussed it in detail at the time, but it's sort of, I suppose the Bowden game, we did kind of feel that one was going to go in that direction, and they got there by a goal in the end in what was a cracking game.
It was, and a nice little link into the hurling final tomorrow as well here, Reg, because Simon Lambert, who's a key member of the Ballyboden hurling team, he's also an integral part of the football team, as he showed last Saturday, when he came on to score a crucial goal for Bowden to help them into the finals for the second consecutive year. Tough battle for them against their near neighbour St Jude's. That they came through, but you know, it was a victory achieved at a price. They lost the goalkeeper, Dara Gogue, and he was red carded. They had no Collie Baskell playing either, who has been such an inspirational figure in their run over the last couple of years. He was injured, and Michael Darren McCauley as well. So again, they showed the true metal of champions and qualified for the final again.
Yeah, and in the other one then, I suppose we kind of, I certainly felt Kilmacud might get the upper hand in that one, but it wasn't to be. Ballymun proving stronger on the day.
Yeah, I do recall saying to you last week, get a 50 pence a piece out and toss it in the air and see which way it would land, and it landed in favour of Ballymun. I thought overall it was a tremendous game of football, two finely tuned teams, well-matched teams, only a couple of points in it at the end. But again, red cards dominating that one, Reg, right at the death with Davy Byrne and Leon Young, both red carded in stoppage time. As it stands, both of them will miss the county final next week, as will Dara Gogan, the Ballyboden goalkeeper, although I think that Ballymun might have a case in appealing Leon Young's red card. But again, a super game of football, 2 points in it at the end, but I felt overall that Ballymun were well worth the victory.
That leads us on to the final, of course, as you mentioned, Ballyboden vying for two titles in both codes, but up against Ballymun, who are strong. What way do you see it going?
Well, just a little statistic about that, if I may. Yeah. I spoke to Brendan Hackett, the Ballymun manager, after the game last week, and we're talking about at that stage the possibility of fans being allowed into the final, which of course, we know it's not going to happen now. But he was telling me that Ballymun Kickums have something like 350 members, right?
Yeah.
What's Ballyboden's membership?
Thousands.
Somewhere in the region of 3,500.
Yeah.
So there you go. Ten times roughly the size of the club. But that matters for little, of course, next Sunday. I'm really, really looking forward to that one as well. A lot will depend on money, if they can get Leon Young back from that red card suspension. And the work that Bowden can do, getting Baskell and Michael Darren McCauley, what their injuries are like. Hopefully they'll be fit to play, because you'd hate to see anyone miss out on a county final. But the Morton Hurling tomorrow, Reg, is going to be a very, very tight game. We'll have a look more in greater detail next week at it.
Excellent stuff. Okay, Declan, I'll let you go. You enjoy the weekend. Before I let you go, there was, of course, that mention of an outbreak in the ladies' hurling squad. 3 cases confirmed of the COVID. So, unfortunate news from there, but I'm sure they'll be doing everything they can to sort that out.
Absolutely. And if I may, just before I go, just congratulate Fox Rock Cap and Teeley on winning their 6th consecutive Dublin Ladies County title last week against Kilmacud Crokes. They will go on and represent the county in Leinster once again, and of course they are the defending champions in the province as well, Reg.
Wonderful stuff. Well done to them. Okay, Declan, we'll chat again next week. You take care of yourself.
Take care, lads. Cheers.
All the best. Declan Drake there giving us his views on the football from last week, and we'll talk to him next week, of course, about that final when Ballyboden will be taking on Ballymun Kickhams. Delighted to be joined on the line now by Alan Colley, football extraordinaire and fashion guru. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Reggie. You were giving me enough stick last night. Now, so tell the listeners the stick you were giving me.
I'll tell you. Well, you looked marvellous in that picture that was tweeted out from the Sligo Bows game last night. I couldn't resist how well you looked. And I was just thinking, you know, Paul Galvin is getting a run for his money. Alan Colley, the sponsors of the podcast, will be knocking down the door. Louis Copeland and boys will be banging down to get you into suits. You're looking so well. That's all I wanted to say.
I could give any of them a run for their money, Reggie.
I wish I could turn out as well as you do. We'll turn back to football now. And I'm going to talk to you in a minute about that, but I want to listen to what Stephen Bradley had to say during the week after that performance that was put in against the great AC Milan.
Unbelievable experience. We knew it was going to be, you know, obviously strange circumstances with no fans being there and everything like that, but you know, the magnitude of the game remained the same. You know, it's still AC Milan coming to town, some top names, some top players, and it was unbelievable to pit our wits against them, but two bits of class have won the game for them tonight, and that's what they are.
I'm really proud of the group. I thought they were outstanding. Two bits of real quality of having done us. You switch off for half a second in the final part of the pitch and you're in trouble. But overall, so proud of how the group attacked the game, how we played. We were brave. We played our way, which was really, really pleasing. Oh, there's massive learnings for us as a club and as a group from tonight. But you're talking about stepping up. You're playing AC Milan. Like, we need to be careful. Like, you know, I thought the players stepped up. I thought they were unbelievable. Not many teams have played that quality of opposition and did what we did in terms of play, created chances. Two bits of quality do us in the end, but overall, they were outstanding. They showed us tremendous respect before the game and afterwards. Paolo Maldini and the coaches, really complimentary of how we play and what we do, and for us that's really good. Like, you know, we need to take tonight now and build on that and learn from it.
Did Maldini speak to you?
Yeah, I spoke to me in the tunnel, and like I said, he was full of praise of the bravery that we showed and played the way we played and how we played. He watched a lot of our games, and like I said, full of compliments for the team, the players, and us as a whole. So like I said, we need to take the positives from this and move on. I think the club have a tremendous relationship with the Lucy Juventus, who we played here a long time ago. They've kept in constant contact, and I'm really sure it'll be the same here. Even Katsidis was obviously at Arsenal when I was there, and we were speaking beforehand, so hopefully the club can keep that relationship going.
Absolutely. Well, it was a great performance, Alan. And that's not in any way to try and sound condescending. I mean, you are up against one of the absolute giants of world football. And I thought, I watched the game. I thought Rovers, you know, conducted themselves admirably.
Yeah, it was a very enjoyable game, Reggie, and you're dead right. They gave a really good account of themselves. And that's not patronising at all, yeah, or condescending. As you say, they really did. They performed really, really well. You heard how proud Stephen Bradley was there in the comments after the match. And he's right, because his team did really well. And AC Milan were very much at it, Reggie, from start to finish. And the one thing we spoke about, I suppose, before the game was the fact that they were in pre-season. And we thought that Shamrock Rovers may be able to catch them in that regard. But it just goes to show the levels of fitness, because even though they were in pre-season, they were still flying around the place. And they were very much, the intensity levels were right up there. And they were really, really good, AC Milan. So for Shamrock Rovers to put in the performance that they did, hold them to two goals, create four very good chances themselves, I felt they should be very, very proud of their performances. And all the players did really well, particularly Lopez, I thought, stood out. Even though he made a mistake for the first goal, he did really well having to deal with Ibrahimovic, because even Ibrahimovic, at the age that he's at, he was still outstanding. And from speaking to some of the lads who were up at the game, apparently he was absolutely outstanding, like in real life, in the flesh. He was brilliant, his movement and all. So it was a good night for Shamrock Rovers. The only downside is the fact that they couldn't cash in relation to crowds and the financial side of things. But in terms of the performance and the football on the pitch, they did really well.
Excellent stuff. Okay. Well, well done to them, and a great boost for the area as well to have the AC Milan boys in town. Mm. Now, I mentioned you were at the game last night, of course, Rovers against Bohemians. Not the highest scoring of games, but I suppose Bohs may have felt that they wanted to get more. But what did you make of it all?
Yeah, it was a good game as well, Reggie. The first half was probably better than the second half, and Bohemians were very impressive in the first half. They created four or five really good chances, and To be honest, they should have been ahead at half time. They were very dominant in the first half. To be fair to Sligo Rovers, they came out very well in the second half and put up a far better performance. And it was more kind of a lot more even in the second half. But Sligo Rovers only created one or two clear cut chances, and Ronan Coughlin had a chance at nil all that he really should have scored, and the game would have been totally different then. But Bohemians were still creating chances despite not being as dominant in the first half. And that little young lad, Dawson Devoy, who I picked out before the match, he was very, very good on the night. He's only 18, Reggie. He's one to watch out for. Another one coming through with the St. Kevin's partnership there with Bohemians that has been very fruitful for them. And he's another one on that kind of production line. He's very, very good. And he set up the winning goal for Andre Wright. So overall, you would have to say Bohemians deserve it. As I said, they were very dominant in the first half, not as much in the second half, but they were the better team overall.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now, Derry City, of course, had St. Pat's in the Brandywell. And it was ended up in a nil-all draw. A little bit surprising,
yeah.
That.
Yeah, and another nil-all for Pats. They're the lowest scorers in the league. I think they've only scored 6 goals, which is really, really surprising, particularly when you look at the creativity that they have in the team and Georgie Kelly up front. But they're really struggling, St. Pat's, this season. And I won't mind, Reggie, I think I said it to you before, we did the first game after the restart against Dundalk, and St. Pat's were absolutely outstanding on the night, and we really thought there was huge potential and huge kind of optimism for the people of Inchicore and St. Pat's that there was a lot of promising stuff coming down the line, but it's been anything but since. They've really struggled, as I say, and it's been a very, very disappointing season for them so far, and again another nil-all draw, and now away to Derry City, and Derry City are obviously a very good side themselves, but they've been something similar to St. Pat's. They've been very disappointing as well this year. Declan Devine last week, they drew nil-all with Finn Harps also, so both teams, Declan Devine and Stevie O'Donnell's teams, have been struggling this season for whatever reason.
Interesting. The Cork Dundalk match has been postponed, so no chance for Dundalk to push further up the table there. But the one that is going ahead there, of course, is a little bit later on, is Shelburne against Finn Harps. Would you imagine Shelburne would be looking towards victory there?
Yeah, I think so. And they've played very well the last week, even though they got beat by Dundalk last week. They played very well on the night, they lost 3-2, but before that, they were unbeaten in 3. And as I said to you before, Reggie, it's just important that they stay in division. But they've done very well, Shelburne. So these are the games that will define their season, playing against the teams that are down around the bottom with them. So the likes of Finn Harps, the likes of Cork. And as you say, it's at home against Finn Harps tonight. They'll be fully expected to get the 3 points because they slipped up in the home game against Cork 2 weeks ago. The only ball to get 3 points, absolutely.
Yeah, well, we're going to turn our attention out to the Premier League across the water. And last week I was pleasantly surprised, obviously, Arsenal getting their 3-0 victory. There was some great football in it. I said to Peter earlier on, I watched the highlights of all the games during the week, and it was great, great goals, great quality. We mentioned that Leeds could be the dark horses of this league. I think they made a great account of themselves in that match against Liverpool.
They were outstanding, Reggie. They really were. Well, we obviously gave them the build-up. And there's been a lot of hype about them, obviously coming back into the top division, which is great, but also a lot of hype about the manager because everybody speaks highly of him and the brilliant job on at Leeds. And now it's brilliant seeing pitting his wits against all the other top managers in the Premier Division, and none bigger than Klopp last week going to Liverpool. And I'd say they give a great account of themselves. It was probably one of the best opening day games we've seen in the Premier League. It was outstanding in terms of the quality. A couple of mistakes. Virgil van Dijk is human, after all, making a mistake. Yeah. But Leeds were brilliant, Reggie. They really were. And they'll trouble a lot of teams this year. I have no qualms whatsoever about them kind of going down. I think they'll be fine. Fulham now, on the other hand, as you say, against Arsenal, I felt they struggled at times. They're trying to play the same way as they played in the Championship. And that's all good and well, playing against lesser teams in the Championship. And even if you make a mistake in terms of trying to play out from the back, you probably won't get as punished. But you see against the likes of Arsenal, one mistake and bang, it's a goal. And that's the difference in quality that they're up against this year. I'd worry a little bit about Fulham and West Brom also. I watched them against Leicester on the Sunday, and they struggled also. But that's to be expected with the teams, because the jump up from the Championship to the Premier League is huge, Reggie. So, yeah. As you say, I don't think Leeds will struggle. I think Leeds will be fine and kind of in around mid-table. But certainly the other two, I think, will struggle.
Alan, Peter here, how are you doing? It's Man United's first game of the season now today against Crystal Palace. How do you think they're, you know, Van der Beek and these guys, how do you think they're going to slot in?
It's interesting to see how they line up now, obviously, Peter, because as you say, the addition of Van der Beek into that midfield, because obviously there's Fernandes, Pogba, I don't think Fred I think he's probably become a squad player now. Also, McTominay did well for him last year, but again, I can only see him as a squad player because, to be fair to Matic, after the restart, he played very well towards the end of the season. So that midfield looks very strong. It'll be interesting to see how he slots them in. But I still think Man United are a good bit off the two or three top teams, and I include Chelsea in that as well. I don't think they've done enough business in the off-season there, Peter, to try and strengthen them to go toe-to-toe with the likes of Man City or Liverpool or Chelsea. So I still see them just competing for those European places, but they won't be challenging for a league this year.
And the FAI women, before we forget, are playing in the Euro 22 qualifier against Germany, and that's live on RT2 from 12:30, so the kick-off is at 1 o'clock today. Again, Vera Pauw seems to be doing a very solid job there with the women's team.
She's done a great job, Peter, but they're right up against today now. I think Germany have scored 31 goals in the campaign so far. They're second in the world. They're an outstanding team. So if they were to pick up anything in that game, it'd be an absolute bonus, to be honest. They're not expected to pick up anything, but they have done very well in the campaign. But the games after this will define, particularly the Ukrainian game away from home, that'll define the campaign, and that'll be the one that'll decide the group in terms of whether to qualify for a playoff or not. But hopefully they're going very well. Sunshine. 106.8 Sunshine 106.8